Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight on Voice of Olympus, I am proud to bring you Living Hellenismos with Tony Merzwicki. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you today?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I just finished enjoying your article in Paphos, and I'm glad that we're going to be expanding upon it here in our conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for coming up with the idea for the blog. I think it's an important topic to cover. The thing is that when people think of the practice of Hellenic religion, they tend to think of Hellenic Reconstructionism. However, there's more than one way to skin a cat, which is a strange expression for an animal able to use. There are other ways of working with the Greek gods which may well work better for particular individuals. So apart from discussing Hellenic Reconstruction, I wanted to talk about Hellenic Wicca, Greek folk magic, channeling, and also ceremonial magic. And if you have anything else to add to that list, I know that you have material on folk magic and channeling, which I'm really looking forward to hearing.
Sure, I'll gladly share my experiences with that. But before we proceed with that, can you, for those who aren't familiar with Hellenismos, can you give a summary of what Greek Reconstructionism is all about?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So I've actually extracted some material from my book, which is titled Hellenismos, and Hellenismos, Practicing Greek Polytheism Today. It came out through Llewellyn a few years ago. So firstly, I point out that many people are familiar with Greek mythology, and it's very much part and parcel of our society and pop culture, because for hundreds of years, a classical education involved the study of ancient Greek and Latin texts, and that was the standard throughout much of the Western world, at least until the 19th century. So ancient Greek writings are of considerable literary and intellectual merit and have stood the test of time. And many of the core values of Western civilization can be attributed to the Greeks, including democracy and the right of individuals to have the freedom of speech. As a byproduct of the widespread awareness of Greek mythology, more and more people are curious as to how the Greeks venerated their gods. So it was actually in the 1990s that there was a revival of ancient Greek religious practices. The Reconstructionists wanted to see the ancient Greek deities restored to their former grandeur. While much of that revival has occurred in Greece, it has rapidly emerged throughout the rest of the world. Reconstructionism is never straightforward, and as far as I'm concerned, there are four important issues that need to be addressed. So firstly, the ancient Greeks had no word for religion, and that's probably because it was seamlessly integrated into everyday life. So as a result, there's no general consensus as to what the current revival should be called. So Greek Reconstructionists will refer to their tradition as Hellenismos or Hellenism or the Hellenic tradition, the Hellenic religion, Hellenic polytheism, while others who focus on the 12 deities from Mount Olympus will refer to their tradition as either Dodecatheism or Olympianism. I personally choose to use the term Hellenismos. And the other thing is that there's no to symbol for Greek religion. So Christians have a crucifix, Wiccans have a pentagram, the heathens or the people who venerate the Norse gods have their hammer of Thor. So a number of religions have symbols that represent them, but there's no symbol for the ancient Greek religion and there's no word for ancient Greek religion. So the second issue that needs to be looked at is whether the practice of Hellenismos should be limited to people of Greek descent. There are a number of groups in Greece who believe that only people with Greek blood should be able to venerate the Greek gods. However, there are historical precedents for non-Greeks working with the ancient Greek gods, and I personally believe that if someone feels called by the gods to venerate them, then they should be allowed to do so. I mean, the will of the gods is what's important, not the will of men. Thirdly,
I've run into what you're describing, and that knife cuts both ways. There were a lot of people in Hellenismos, and even that term is ambiguous, as I'll explain later, that I'm a native Greek. I'm of Greek descent and Greek acculturation, and to a lot of people who weren't Greek, and this still holds true to people that I speak to who are involved in the honoring of the Greek gods, there's something bad about being Greek, which is very weird. So I can understand both sides of that dilemma.
Why would there be something bad about being Greek?
Well, they argue that the Greeks of today are not the Greeks of yesteryear, and again, that is contradicted by looking at Greek statues from antiquity and looking at Greek people, you know, wandering around today. When the English and other Europeans were taking the treasures from Greece back to their countries, they had said that the Greek people of today are descended from Slavic people, so they're not even the same people as antiquity, as justification for taking the treasures. They weren't robbing these people of their past heritage. These weren't the same people. And that persists in the minds of people who are not Greek, who follow the Greek gods, that the people who call themselves Greek have no right to this heritage, in that they're not the same people. And even if they were, they surrendered the heritage to become Christians, and therefore it's no longer theirs.
Well, it is true that many Greeks have surrendered their heritage in order to become Christians and fall under the yoke of the Greek Orthodox Church. However, I remember a recent study that looked at the DNA of ancient Greeks and modern Greeks, and they concluded that the Greeks of today are the same as the Greeks of ancient times. So, I mean, the idea of current Greeks being descended from Slavs is spurious. It was, as you said, it was just an excuse to pillage Greek archaeological sites and steal statues of incredible value and take them back to England and other countries.
And also memory of things, like, for instance, when I was growing up, I grew up with stories of being able to see Troy from Limnos, and which is the island where my ancestors are mostly from, and also how this island where they had, like, they had grew crops was once a trading center during the Trojan War, and during the Trojan War, you know, there was active trade going on, and all these stories that the Lemnians remembered were later proven to be true archaeologically. So Nakukonitsi, which is this island, is acknowledged to have been a thriving trading center during the time of the Trojan War. But again, until archaeology went and proved that it was just something Lemnians said. The Lemnians also preserve memories of the Argonauts and all sorts of other mythical and historical things. Again, the memories live on, but there too, unless it was accepted by European scholars, it wasn't considered to be to have veracity to it.
That's such a shame. It was much the same thing in Egypt, where a lot of European Egyptologists maintained that the Egyptians weren't African. They were light-skinned people who had come into Egypt because they couldn't get their heads around Africans creating such incredible, incredible monuments. But when you look at paintings from the walls of Egyptian tombs, you'll see that there are people there that the Egyptians were portrayed as either being light-skinned or dark-skinned. That they were both. So ancient Egypt seemed to be quite a melting pot. And those tomb paintings speak for themselves. It doesn't really matter what Egyptologists say. All they're trying to do is to fit things to a narrative, bend the facts to fit a narrative, which just isn't true.
And conversely, the Greeks themselves, it was the culture that made one Greek, not genetics in antiquity.
Yeah.
So areas that came under Elenismos, and even today, the word Elenismos to Greek doesn't mean the same thing that it means to non-Greek. Elenismos means Greek influence. So anything that promotes positive Greek influence is Elenismos, and that could translate into political, cultural, you know, any type of influence that portrays Greeks in a positive light and brings benefit to Greece. So when I was growing up, the term Elenismos applied to what organizations like AHEPA, which is a very Greek Orthodox society, was doing. They were actively spreading Elenismos to the world. And so it struck me as odd that the term was used to describe the ancient Greek religion. People who studied the ancient Greek religion and liked Greek things were called Philhellenes, or Philhellenes, as it's translated into English. Again, you're right. There is a big terminology problem going on.
Yeah, the reason why I chose the term Hellenismos was that it was the term that was used by the Emperor Julian. He was mm-hmm. the last pagan emperor of Rome. And one of the things that he tried to do in his all too short reign was to bring back the worship of the Greek gods. And he called that Hellenismos. So I see what we're doing as paralleling what he tried to do during his reign. So in homage to him, that's why I choose the term Hellenismos. But, you know, I understand that other people may be more comfortable with some of the other terms which I previously mentioned.
Well, those are good points. The fact that the modern Hellenic spirituality does not have a symbol or even a name for itself, that can be positive too.
But it's so much easier if there's a definite name, because that way we'd all be able to agree on the name and use it. So the whole thing kind of feels slippery, for want of a better word, because there's no one name for the ancient Greek religion. And as I mentioned, I believe that it's because the religion was so seamlessly integrated into everyday life, they did not think of it as something separate. Whereas in this day and age, we have our secular life, and then separate from that, we've got our spiritual life, so we can come up with a name for that. But as soon as you integrate everything together, you're just dealing with life. That's it.
Very true. That's how I view it as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I covered the first two factors that need to be considered. The third one is just which ancient Greek religious practices need to be revived. The Greek religion was characterized by appeals to ancient tradition and was simple in practice. There was, however, no one religion which was practiced by all Greeks, but rather there were variations in different regions, and even these variations were subject to change over time. There was also a significant difference between religious practices in public rituals and those in the home. So there are some reconstructionists who limit themselves to the 12 Olympian deities, which are arguably the central aspect of ancient Greek religion. But this limitation ignores all the non-Olympian deities, the daemons or spirits, the heroes and ancestors. So the simple answer is that just as there are numerous ways of practicing ancient Greek religion, so too there are numerous ways of practicing Hellenismos, each equally valid, with individual practitioners freely developing their own personalized version. It's a matter of seeing what you resonate with, what works with you. And at the end of the day, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If you're getting results using your particular variation, then that is what you should stick with. Just because someone else is doing something else doesn't mean you need to slavishly follow it. Find your own path.
I agree.
Okay, so fourth and lastly, are all practices suitable for contemporary practitioners? So much within the ancient Greek religion was noble, but it was part of a cultural milieu, or social environment and that entailed animal sacrifice, occasional human sacrifice, slavery, the subordination of women, the practice of magic and copious drug use. Greek religion was a product of its time, and as such it was paralleled by numerous other religions. Times have changed, and there is a clear need for adaptation. Thus, Hellenismos should not be a reconstruction of ancient Greek religion as it was, but rather a reconstruction of what Greek religion plausibly would have been had it survived. It is known that the religion changed in ancient times in response to changing needs as time passed, and so it would have kept changing had it survived until today. At the risk of stating the obvious, no laws should be broken by the practice of Hellenismos, and there can be numerous equally valid ways of practicing the faith. What I was trying to make is that there is scope for a number of plausible reconstructions of ancient Greek religion. I've actually come across people claiming that their way of venerating the ancient Greek gods is the only way of venerating them. I've also come across people, this is going back a few years ago, I'm not sure if it still goes on or not, people were saying that you needed to engage in animal sacrifice in order to venerate the ancient Greek gods. And I remember there was one person who had a chicken farm, and they were looking for Greek reconstructions to go over and help this person slaughter chickens. And then while they're slaughtering the chickens, they're basically making sacrifice to the gods, but it just looked like free help. I'm personally vegetarian, so I won't sacrifice anything, but that is my personal core value. And Burkert actually pointed out that the most popular or the most common offering was to drop a grain of frankincense onto the fire and offer that to the gods. You know, meat was a luxury item, and a lot of the people in ancient Greece were vegetarian most of the time, not by choice, but because meat was a luxury item. So when they had a thusia, which was a public animal sacrifice, at the end of it, the meat would be divided between those people who had attended. So for the poor people, that was the only time that they had meat in their diet. The rest of the time they were vegetarian. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that's an old Reconstructionist article. I remember way back in the 70s, I guess, there were some Hellenic groups that lived on farms and sacrificed animals. One of the points of disagreement I had with the Reconstructionist groups that I've interacted with is that they picked and chose they cherry-picked and chose what went into the Reconstructionism and let go of things that were no longer as palpable to moderns, and yet insisted that their choices in what they cherry-picked were the only correct choices, and that everybody else's choices were poor choices. I also don't believe in sacrificing animals or slavery or suppressing women or any of that stuff. And my relationship with the ancient Hellenic gods is just fine.
You know, cherry picking just seems to be part of human nature. You see it in Christianity all the time, where there are certain, basically you pick out the things in the Bible which align with your own prejudices. So a lot of people point to homosexuality as being wrong, but things like adultery, and interestingly, adultery is in the Ten Commandments. Homosexuality isn't.
It's not.
You think that adultery would be a greater sin than homosexuality, but yet a lot of Christians seem to be okay with adultery, but they're not okay with homosexuality. So again, they're cherry-picking things out of the Bible which resonate with their own personal values. So you mentioned that there are Hellenic reconstructionists still basically doing the same thing. Mind you, I'm guilty of that too, because I'm picking out as many things in Greek religion as can be used today, but cutting out the things which I don't think are appropriate for this day and age. So things like public animal sacrifice, I can't see us ever going back to that. I mean, that's why religions like Santeria have so much trouble with the authorities. They want to practice public animal sacrifice, so they wind up having to do it in secret. I, much prefer doing things out in the open, have as many people involved as possible. So rather than sacrifice an animal, why not have an effigy of an animal and offer that to the god that you're working with?
Growing up Greek in New York, the Greeks used to get the ASPCA called on them every time around Easter, because many of the Greeks who had backyards, they would buy a lamb and then kill it for Easter. And somebody would, of course, be very upset by this and call the ASPCA, and that was always something going on continuously in the Greek community.
I was told a few years ago that that still goes on in Greece, where if you need to have a lamb for, you know, say at the end of Easter, you want to make Psito Aroni. I still remember the name for it. That means roast lamb. They'll basically just kill a lamb by the roadside for you and then sell it to you. So it still goes on. So it's just a matter of if you are killing an animal, then offer its spirit to a particular god that you're working with. If you're a hunter, and you're hunting for your family's meal, then again, you can do the same thing. Or if you're a fisherman, offer the spirit of the seafood which you capture to Poseidon or some other marine god. I can justify that, but I think if anyone else needs to have meat for a sacrifice, just go to a supermarket and get it out of a plastic packet. Use that. I don't think the gods are going to be too upset. Or use an effigy. That's actually my preference.
You're right about all of us cherry-picking, but all of us don't insist that our way is the only correct way. It's the correct way for us. That's what the difference is.
I mean, that was the whole point of this blog. I mean, I've got my preferred path, but the thing is that there are other people who will prefer other paths. So the next thing I was actually going to talk about was Hellenic Wicca. So as you know, underneath the pagan umbrella, the largest group that we have are the Wiccans. So many of those Wiccans are very comfortable with what they're doing, and if they want to start playing around with other gods, then they will incorporate the worship of those gods. So I just wanted to point out that Wicca is a modern pagan religion, and it was developed in England during the first half of the 20th century and was introduced to the public in 1954 by Gerald Gardner. So that was just after the Witchcraft Act was repealed. So Wicca is typically duotheistic, and they worship or work with a goddess and a god. These are traditionally viewed as the triple goddess and the horn god respectively. Sometimes they're referred to as the lord and the lady. So they can be seen, the Lord can be seen as combining all male deities, and the lady can be conceived as combining all female deities. So it's just a short step to go from that to narrow your focus to the Hellenic deities and engage in Hellenic Wicca. So the thing is that if you're already trained in Wicca, and you don't want to start investigating how the ancient Greeks venerated their gods, then you can still call the quarters, cast the circle, do everything else, and just call in the gods. And what it comes down to is whether the gods come to you, whether you're getting results or not. If you are getting results, then there's no reason to change. Another interesting thing is that the classical elements, as we know them, earth, air, fire, water, and ether, came to us from the ancient Greeks. The Wiccans work a lot with the elements. So again, there's another thing where you've got everything blending in seamlessly. So the point is, if so many modern-day pagans are Wiccans and they want to stay practicing Wicca and they want to play around with the ancient Greek gods, just work with those gods within a Wiccan framework. If they choose to try something a little bit more traditional later on, then great. But if they're getting results, it really doesn't matter. I mean, you and I have had discussions on this before, that it really doesn't matter how you work with the Greek gods, so long as you work with them and you develop a relationship with them. I can imagine a lot of Hellenic Reconstructionists disagreeing with us, but my aim is to just have people working with the Greek gods.
I would agree. And yes, I've heard the dialogues on both sides of that question too. And from a, I guess, a more traditional standpoint, they were both inventions of people, and mostly modern people. What people are doing and calling Reconstructionism or calling Wicca. When you get into the folk magic, I'll talk a little bit more about how the whole narrative about the fam trads back in the 70s and the 60s, I remember, those were very inaccurate and misleading if you wanted to get involved with Wicca and the Greek gods.
Well, actually, I was going to talk about Greek folk magic next.
Yes.
And I had trouble finding any information about it online. There was only one guy who I found, and I'll detail him in a second. But I remember coming across a book a few years ago, and I'm struggling to remember the name of it, but it pointed out that the very first spirit entities that were worked with in Greece were the nymphs, particularly the water nymphs around brooks and streams. And so they were the first ones that were worked with. So then the Greek religion took off and was suppressed by Christianity. And after it was suppressed by Christianity, there were still old ladies in far outlying villages that are still working with the nymphs. So the point that the author was trying to make was that the water nymphs were the first spirit entities worked with, and now they're the last ones that have been worked with. So they're very very pernicious, for want of a better word. But before I let you share what you know about folk magic, I wanted to mention that I came across one guy online. He calls himself Heliodoros, and he's from Athens in Greece, and he describes himself as an artist and a writer, as well as a lifelong scholar of religion and a former student of theology at the University of Athens. He's developing his own system, which he calls the Triskelion Path, and it comprises of Hellenic polytheism, or Hellenismos, as I call it, witchcraft, and ecstatic spirit work. So his thoughts on Greek folk magic are that it is mainly usage of herbal lore, folklore, that is stories and legends dealing with the other world, like fae and nymphs, chants, incantations, simple spells, superstitious actions, casting out the evil eye, etc. He says that he's well versed in this because he's experienced it way before he even knew what witchcraft was. Simple formulae, like using herbs in a certain way, specific actions to bring about a desired effect, words of power, etc., are common methods of Greek folk magic. Its characteristics are simplicity and effectivity. It touches the field of superstition because the old formulae can easily be shrugged off as nonsensical or their meanings forgotten. It can be exceptionally potent, though, mainly due to the faith and energy backing it up through the centuries. And also in his blog, he cites a few examples of herbal magic for the more adventurous readers to work through. And when I was reading that, it made me think of you, because he said that he was brought up exposed to these herbal workings, these Greek folk magic workings. So from what you've told me privately, you were as well. So I'd really love you to share some of the things that you've picked up over the years.
What has struck me is he's putting together a system. So I can see where he's cherry picking and picking and choosing from a bunch of different things and tying them together. There is a magical tradition, and at least in my youth, when I used to go to Greece every summer, and I was more immersed in Greek things and Greek people. There were a lot of things people did in the villages. And in my childhood, there was no reliable electricity. They had electricity, but it was off as often as it was on. You had to go to the nearest Vrisi or where they had like a pump to get your water to bring it to your house. The water that you got at your house wasn't drinkable unless you boiled it. You could bathe in it, but that's about it. Also, they had radio, and television was a myth. And I remember an uncle smacked me once when I described television because I was lying. People did things like the herbal things, like in Limnos, at least where I came from, chamomile or chamomile was a panacea. Just most things, chamomile would cure them. Fascomile or mountain sage was another panacea. If chamomile didn't help with it, then mountain sage would help with it. And there were people who had lore. And I remember because doctors used to come, they used to go to towns on rotation, and they used to see people and animals, too, that were brought to them. And I remember one time I had what, when I came back to the States, it was called a pneumonia, a walking pneumonia. There I was told that somebody put the evil eye on me, and I had to find an evil eye practitioner. And the treatment consisted of them massaging my neck with olive oil and chanting what sounded like mathematical equations. I felt a little better, but didn't get diagnosed until I came back here with pneumonia, and they gave me something that knocked it out of my system. But that was the milieu, and you had these people who were like witch doctors. You know, they didn't dress up like witch doctors. They dressed up like everybody else. But they would come to your house, and there was one time I remember they were chanting, and there was the charcoal circle, and there was frankincense, and occasionally they put cinnamon on it. And sometimes in response to certain words, the cloves would explode. You know, and that was very impressive, and that was part of the ritual that they did. And they had all these rules for it, like somebody can only give this information to somebody on their deathbed, and there were certain like conditions of age and sex for the person receiving the information. So a lot of that information was lost each generation, as you can imagine, because it's very hard to meet the conditions when you're dying. For carrying on the information. But it was a living thing, as were a lot of practices like jumping over bonfires, and the evil eye was a real thing that you had to deal with. When I first read about the Wicca in late 60s, early 70s, I could understand what the person was saying about famtrads, because I guess that would come under famtrad information. But these people considered themselves Christians. The practices were ancient, but the religion that they had was a totally different thing. So they weren't perpetuating paganism, or they would have been appalled if told that they were perpetuating paganism. And the Wiccan elements that I read about, too, were absent. You know, there was no god and no goddess. There were a bunch of gods and a bunch of goddesses. And even though people were Christians, in their homes, they had statues of gods. And if they had money outside their house, they had statues of gods. And they had pillars from antiquity. And the stories I grew up with were all about antiquity, how Greeks are descended from gods and demigods and all these things, and that it was our responsibility to Hellenize the world. You know, so it was a different reality, and it didn't really match the reality that was being conveyed in the Wiccan literature at the time. But there wasn't like a college of witch doctors or a group of witch doctors, getting together. And, they're mostly just individuals who are passing on a secret knowledge and using it to heal.
Wow. Okay. Three thoughts on the base of what you were talking about. initially started off talking about chamomile as a panacea. And this is just going off on a hell of a tangent. In the 90s, a buddy of mine told me that he went to a little town back in Australia, and he went into a little store, and he ordered a cup of chamomile tea. The waitress giggled at him, and he asked, "Why, what's so funny?" And she told him that whenever any of the women in the town have their periods and they're having a painful period, then they come in and order chamomile tea. So it was only women on their periods who ever drank chamomile tea in this town. So that was like the folk remedy in this small Australian town. Just one of these stories I've tucked away. Was it used for period pain back in Greece as well?
I don't know. I've never had period pain, so I can't really tell you. I know that mostly for stomach-related, nausea-related type of ailments, chamomile was given. And for things who are a little bit, more like a cold or cough-related or they were a bit more complicated than stomach ailments, Fascomili was or Venetia, as it's sometimes called, of the mountains, was prescribed. And looking back in my childhood, those two things comprised most of my healing at home, and vinduzis, which are the cups, where you take a cotton ball and put it in a cup, and you put some alcohol on the cotton ball and you light it, and then you put it on your back. And if it turned dark, then it was drawing out harmful vapors, and you were sick. The darker the circles got with the cups, the sicker you were, and you needed more cups. So, yeah, there were things like that. And there were other remedies as well, but those are the ones I remember the clearest.
I've heard of athletes, high-level athletes, using that cupping procedure, but I had no idea that it originally came from Greece. That's actually quite fascinating.
Yeah, vinduzis, they were called.
Yeah, the other thing that you mentioned were famtrads. My understanding of famtrads is that they're basically witchcraft traditions that go back before Wicca. The thing with Wicca is that it was put together by Gerald Gardner. And Gerald Gardner was in the OTO. He was fourth degree, and his magical name was Scryer. And he actually got Aleister Crowley to write his rituals for him. So there's this huge Crowleyan influence in Wicca. And so I think of it as something fairly modern, but famtrad stuff is supposed to be literally family traditions that go back many decades, if not centuries. I came across some people here in California. I can't really mention the name of the group, but they say that they go back to the 17th century or the 1700s in France. So it's supposed to be a witchcraft group that started off then in France, and it's now present here in the U.S. So that's kind of what I think of when I think of famtrads.
Practices that people pass on, and some of the practices belong to families, but they're customs. And I think until the whole concept of famtrads was introduced into the picture, they weren't, they might have been considered family traditions, which is what famtrads mean, but it wasn't seen in the same light as, a famtrad. They were just, every family has customs, like how they honor the gods in the house, and how they purify the house and seal the windows and the doors. There's all sorts of things that are generally, universally done, or at least they were when I was growing up. But every household had their own particular way of doing it, just like every household had a bunch of names that were tied to saints that repeated generation after generation. So those were family traditions, but there wasn't a sense of preserving an ancient paganism. It was just stuff your family did, you know.
The other thing that you mentioned was these older ladies in Greece who'd be practicing the old ways, but it was all very heavily Christianized. And the thought that I had going through my mind was connected to Strega. The thing with the Inquisition is that it went north of the Vatican and then spread through Europe. They didn't go south of the Vatican, which meant that the people in the south of Italy, in particular Calabria and Sicily, were able to pursue their traditions unmolested. So they would practice witchcraft, but because Christianity was so powerful, it came in and Christianized a lot of these practices. So apparently with women who practice Strega, they don't think of themselves as witches. They think of themselves as Christian women, they do a couple of unusual things. And one thing that I was told was that they will go to church, you know, most Sundays, but the one Sunday that they all go to church is the feast day of St. Michael. For some reason, they have this thing for St. Michael, you know, Michael the Archangel.
Mm-hmm.
The other country that's similar to that is Serbia. The thing with the Serbian Orthodox Church was that it split off from the main body of the Orthodox Church. So it split off from the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, and it was very, very small. Being small, it wasn't particularly powerful. They tried to draw in as many people as possible to it. So as a result, they turned their back on a lot of folk magic practices. So you have a lot of people in Serbia practicing folk magic, and the church just kind of ignores it because they don't want these people. Yeah, they look the other way because they want to have as many members as possible. You know, whereas the Greek Orthodox Church has been particularly ruthless, the Catholic Church has been particularly ruthless with anyone who doesn't toe the line. But
and
there
yet
were, there were
in the Greek Orthodox Church, they permitted, yeah, you know, they allowed this. This went on, like the jumping over the bonfires was done on a main road, I remember. They had the Seder ceremony, which was supposed to be discontinued back in antiquity. I've seen that, you know, when I was a kid. So these things continued, and the churches kind of looked the other way. It was something that people did, you know, and it was, a custom. It was a local tradition. Again, as long as people were going to church, they didn't really interfere with a lot of these local traditions. And Greeks honor their antiquities. So I believe it has, and I was told when I was growing up that obviously I resonate with Olympus, that there's a heaven for virtuous pagans, but you could visit the Christian heaven because you're Greek. So it's a hodgepodge strange beliefs. I think what I'm trying to convey is I have no doubt that these things persisted and existed because I've experienced it personally. But what I found consistent also was that there wasn't a sense, as there seemed to be with the resurgence of paganism in America and England, that there was a preservation of an ancient system of belief. It was just there was a system of curative information, you know, healing information, and that's what was being preserved. And that these things were very old, and they worked, and they needed to be passed on in a very magical way in order to be efficacious. There were family traditions, and there is secret information, but it wasn't in the same context as the presentation of it. Like the person you told me about, I'm curious to see what he'll do, because even though a lot of this folkloric information that he's referring to is regional, it is also surprisingly widespread. Like I found out some very obscure Lemnian figures were actually spread throughout Greece, like Guarapas. There was a lot of stories about Arapas means Moor or the dark-skinned person. And the story is that he was a slave of the Muslims during the occupation, and he died, but somehow he became like a Freddy Krueger type figure. He became a dream demon. And he would promise you a treasure, and if you accepted the treasure, you'd find it, but it would lead to all sorts of horrible misfortune. And, you know, there were other figures like that. And then that Ibis that you talk about, and that Ibis were, spoken of as if the hills were full of Naraibis. Naraibis were the most common exotic folklore creature that people would encounter in the Limnos that I was growing up in. You know, there were always stories of Naraibis and Kalikanzari, the stories are that they're actually like decaying forms of the ancient folklore creatures of Greece, the centaurs and the satyrs and so forth. They're kind of like shadows of themselves, but it's usually translated goblin, the Kalikanzari, and there were Airika, which are kind of like sylphs. You know, they're aerial creatures. I guess UFO aliens, a lot of how they're described would fall into that category too. So there's this rich folklore, which not only is being shared in terms of stories, like folklore stories or things that happened, like urban legends, but lots of people still experience that. In Limnos, I heard these stories, unless I was in a village where they didn't know me. And then that was something that ignorant people believe. But then when they get to know you, you hear all the personal accounts. So it's amazing. I found a couple of books on that, and they're treasured books in my library. One of them doesn't have a cover, but they're all about the folklore as well. So I'm curious to see what folklore he weaves into his system.
Like I said, I just came across them when I was doing searches online. And to be honest, if I had come across someone who had a scholarly text on folk magic practice throughout the length and breadth of Greece, or had at least access to scholarly texts like that, then I would have used him preferentially. But he was the only person I could find who said that he was working with folk magic. I just got the impression that there are these little old ladies out in Greece who are practicing herbal magic, but none of this stuff's being recorded anywhere, which is a damn shame. I'd like to see someone doing, you know, a thesis or a PhD thesis in anthropology, just collecting all this information so it's not lost. You know, much as people have collected information on fairies and the like in the United Kingdom, it'd be really good if they could collect something like that. But it comes down to how much work he wants to put into it. Does he want to gather information on herbal lore throughout the length and breadth of Greece, or is he just going to limit himself to the stuff that he grew up with? If it's his own personal system and he doesn't want anyone else to particularly work with it, then I can imagine him doing that and justifying his lack of any further research on the basis of, well, this is what the gods opened me up to, and this is what I'm going to work with. I wish there was more information out there, but there just isn't.
If there is in Greek. There have been, I know on Limnos again, I could always speak to what my personal experience is. I heard later on from my family who continued going there that they started like folklore societies. They were collecting the dances and the folklore. And my family, my parents gathered quite a big collection of books on Limnos and the history, the mythic history, the culture. I've now have these books in my possession. I haven't had a chance to look through them all, and also my Greek is not what it used to be. So it's going to take me a lot longer to pour through them and read them, and I'll need a dictionary, no doubt, to tackle some of it. But I believe that efforts were taken to collect this data by folklore societies.
That would be great. I don't claim to have done any comprehensive searches on the matter, but just going through YouTube, I've come across what you're talking about, dances being collected, and I've also come across studies done by linguists where they found pockets of people who are talking in ancient dialects. So there's one part of the place where people are talking in the ancient Spartan dialect. So I'd love to see all that material preserved, because once the people who speak those dialects or dance those dances or heal with those particular herbs go, then their traditions may well die with them. So for the benefit of posterity, we need to record everything. Okay, so the next thing I was going to talk about was the idea of channeling Hellenic deities. So back in 2010, Huffington Post uploaded an article called 5 Steps to Channeling Your Very Own Greek Goddess, which summarized the approach used by Agapi Stassinopoulos. And she is the sister of Ariana Stassinopoulos Huffington.
Yes.
And Ariana Huffington is actually, she's a prolific author, a co-founder of Huffington Post, so that's why the name sounds so familiar, and the founder and CEO of Thrive Global. So Agapi has a master's in psychology from the University of Santa Monica. She has a great love for the Greek gods and goddesses and is the author of numerous books.
Yeah.
And she conducts seminars worldwide. So the person who wrote the article had attended one of her seminars and has summarized the approach that she uses. So it's a 5-step approach. So the first step is to know your archetype. You determine what your archetype is and you embrace it. So already there, you're going to upset a lot of Hellenic reconstructionists because they're going to say that the Greek gods are real. You have to consider them as real, not just as archetypes. Step two is to know what archetype you're not. So unresolved psychology, misaligned choices can have us believing we are an archetype that we aren't, and this is what we need to heal. The third step is to reflect with compassion. Once we embrace who we are with compassion, we can make a conscious decision to invite useful qualities into our lives that can lead us to where we need to go. The fourth step is irrelevant. The gods and goddesses have no time frame. They're not American. They don't need things done like within a weekend. So things happen in their own time and in their own cycle, which often means that patience is required. And you need to know deep down that everything is as it should be. So even though you may think that nothing's happening, it is, but it's happening very, very slowly. And the fifth step, which I really like, is to get into your body. So they say that physicality, such as yoga, increases the ability to begin to tap into the emotions. And self-compassion is important. You leave space for feelings to rise to the surface. So some sort of physical activity is very, very important. I mean, you and I like to work out in a gym, so hopefully that's as good as yoga. And the bonus step that was given was to share your feelings with someone who, it's not always easy, but apparently it leads to further growth. So that's the 5-step approach which she uses in her seminars. So she travels around the world and teaches people to channel the Greek gods and goddesses. So, but you've mentioned that you've come across people who channel the Greek gods.
Oh yes, I've had some of them on the show, and I've talked to the, you know, what they're channeling on the show, and received insights. But it seems to be very prevalent now in some of the cosmic spiritualities and in some of the pagan circles. There's a lot more channeling going on in Wicca and paganism than there was, again, when I was actively engaged in exploring those things. Several of the Wicca groups that have interacted with, they channel the gods and the goddesses of Greek mythology. I've had several conversations with Athena through different people, as well as my Athena, who's downstairs right now.
Funny. In Hellenic reconstructionism, there's a term that's often used, UPG, unverified personal gnosis. which I assume would be much the same as channeling, where once you develop a relationship with a god or a goddess, you channel information. And then it's up to you to use discernment to work out how valid that information is. Now, in general, that's information that's for your own path. You're not really supposed to spread it. So that's one of the issues that I have with Agape, saying that you should be sharing your feelings with other people. So I think that if you say it's just the feeling, you mention it's your own path, then that's okay. But once you start presenting your UPGs as something that's an absolute truth, then I think you're on shaky ground. But things start to get very interesting with UPGs once you have two or more people channeling UPGs and from different backgrounds, and they're very, very similar.
Yes.
So once you start channeling information that's similar from people who have no connection, then you realize that you're dealing with something which may well be objectively true, not just subjectively true.
I my system of verifying things, there are certain people I know who've consistently over the years, even though they don't know each other and they wouldn't agree with each other if they had a conversation about spirituality or magic because they're standing in totally different places, will give me very similar, sometimes almost word-for-word information that might come to me in a dream or during a meditation. So
wow.
They're aware of where they claim. Like I remember once I had gotten this really strong perspective in a dream and then in my meditation, but I shelved it because it was too big to really look at. And my first assumption is these are coming from my own subconscious, you know, rather than being a different communication. And then for weeks, I had synchronicities and I had the people communicating messages that they got from me from Zeus. And again, they don't know each other. They don't communicate with each other. And they would have very strong disagreements about how they each approach spirituality. But the messages were identical to what I was getting. They were even worded identically. So yes, you're absolutely right that sometimes UPGs, if you get it from enough mouths, become, no longer unverified or no longer personal, just nonsense.
Also, for your own, you need to verify that you're actually getting a message from the deity that you think it's coming from. So
right.
It's not from some other entity. So you need to have finely honed discernment to work that out. So whether you're working with your intuition or maybe a tarot reading or something, you need to have some sort of tool available to you that you can verify this thing. I mean, after all, there are people locked up in institutions by men in white coats or on Thorazine drips who hear voices. So you need to make sure that you're actually channeling something real and not something within your own head.
Right. I assume that everything is within my own head unless I receive some sort of confirmation otherwise. And wow, this hour passed by very quickly. So we'll probably do a part two on this. Thank you very much, Tony. This was very informative. It was very stimulating and very entertaining. And I'm glad that we did this. I'm looking forward to doing it again. How can people contact you and enter your world?
The best way to do it is to come onto Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. And I also have a Pathos blog, which is called Holistic Spirituality. So basically the only stuff that we didn't cover was I was looking at ceremonial magic. So I was looking at various texts because there's been quite a lot of Greek influence within ceremonial magic. So I've got a whole lot of material there, which we didn't get a chance to get to. So if you like, we could either cover that in the next show, or we could just refer people to read it. I don't mind either way. but I thought that today's topic was very important, just to show that there's not just one way of working
right.
with the Greek gods. So you don't have to do it the way it was done in ancient times, or I present Hellenismos. If you're working with a system that you're comfortable with, you can stick with that.
Very well said, and an excellent place to end today's show. Thank you again very much, and thanks to everybody who tuned in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Tony.
Thanks, Hercules, and good night.
Good night.